On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Knows me as a person who got beat up by the cop, but you know, the real Rodney King is a can we all get along type of guy.
I'm not the type of person that they have portrayed me to be over the years. That's one reason why I wrote my book, so people can have a clear understanding of me and what I feel my purpose is on earth.
And that was Rodney King in his final interview, taped 2 weeks before his death in 2012. He was promoting his book, A Riot Within. 25 years ago today, his brutal beating by the LAPD was caught on video. The 9 minutes of grainy footage put an angry national spotlight on how the LAPD treated black people. The department has been through many reforms since then, but distrust between police and communities of color continues nationwide. And violence caught on camera has played a bigger and bigger role in that. Darnell Hunt is a sociology professor and director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA, and it's good of you to join us today.
No, I'm happy to be here.
Well, back in 1991, African Americans had been complaining about the LAPD and brutality for years. So remind us, what was the impact, though, of having that actual footage?
Well, the footage made all the difference. I mean, you're right. For generations, African Americans have been protesting, complaining about police brutality. There's been a long-standing relationship between black communities and LAPD where the communities felt like they were being, you know, occupied by, you know, patrolling troops. And so to finally have someone just, almost an accident, you know, happened to be outside with his camcorder, which was relatively new technology then, George Holliday, and to capture all this on videotape, it was a game changer. The video went viral. I mean, around the world, everybody saw it and, assumed that justice would be served once the video became public knowledge.
What was your reaction, personally, when you saw it?
Well, I mean, I remember it vividly, and I remember thinking, wow, this is intense. And, you know, I assumed, like most people, based on the savage beating, that the officers would be found guilty of using excessive force. And of course, when they were largely exonerated by the verdicts, the town just erupted into bedlam, and I don't think anyone really knew at that point what was going to happen.
And again, because I think a lot of us might have forgotten, who was George Holliday, the guy who took the Rodney King beating video?
Well, he just happened to be there, and I think he, if I remember correctly, he heard what was going on across the street. He just pulled out his camcorder and videotaped it.
He had just gotten the thing, right?
Yeah.
A plumber? He owned his own plumbing
contract? I can't remember exactly what his occupation was, but more importantly, he took it to KTLA, Channel 5 News. And that was really the beginning of the whole world becoming aware of this video. KTLA showed it. It was shown over and over and over again. And, well, the rest is history.
And since, again, we don't remember much about his personal circumstances, do you know how he was treated publicly at the time and how his life was affected by shooting that video?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I don't really know the answers to that question. I mean, I do know that he was, at least initially, his name was known because it was referred to as the Holliday video. And so everyone knew, you know, at the time, you know, how the video came about once it, you know, became public. You know, it's been 25 years, and, you know, I wrote a book on this, that came out a few years after that, you know, which really looked at media coverage of the uprisings that followed the verdicts. But you don't hear many people talking about George Holliday, the man, as much as you just hear his name associated with the video.
And in your book, and since, you've been really critical of how the media covered the King beating and the video footage. So what were the problems that you saw in that coverage?
Well, I mean, I think, one of the things I found in doing the research for the book was that the people who participated in the 1992 L.A. uprisings did so for a number of different reasons. Obviously, the whole thing was sparked by the verdicts, the not guilty verdicts, and the King beating trial. But I think that was just the tip of the iceberg. Beneath the surface, there were all these other festering issues that had existed in L.A. inner-city communities for generations that not only involved African-Americans, but also involved Latinos. In fact, more Latinos were arrested than African-Americans in 1992. So the media coverage tend to frame it solely in terms of the verdicts, which conveniently left out of the narrative all the other age-old issues and concerns that motivated people. And the media tended to focus on breaking news. There's a fire over here, or a store over here is being looted, and paid much less attention to actual underlying causes, which was my primary critique. And, you know, I was interested in how people at home were watching the news. And what I found was that people who lived in those communities and or who knew people who had certain types of experiences were much more critical of the news. And part of what I was studying was how one's location in society, your racial background, you know, the geography, you know, where you live, your class background, how those things shape the way you bring your own experiences to watching the news.
Well, and now with smartphones and social media, we have so much more of this kind of footage. So what similarities or differences do you see in how these videos are covered by the media now versus back in 1991?
Well, social media is everything now. I mean, you know, everything has changed. I mean, you know, the camcorder was, a meaningful invention, in terms of capturing on videotape things that people had alleged for years but couldn't actually prove. Now, of course, everyone has a cell phone, and every cell phone captures video and can take photographs. And so, you know, all of these high-profile instances of police brutality we see around the country, that we've seen around the country in recent years, probably would have gone relatively unheeded in the past had it not been for this new technology and the fact that people can get out their own news now and they don't have to rely upon the mainstream media. The mainstream media, of course, are invested in being at the table and being in the game, so they cover the videos that individuals shoot. But I think that we have an interesting moment in history where we have parallel sources of information about events that in the past we just wouldn't have known existed, and we wouldn't have had the actual video proof the way we do now.
And has all this avalanche of footage, has it really helped hold police accountable or more accountable, or is it just mounting evidence that we have the same problems that we had 25 years ago?
Well, we certainly have the same problems we had 25 years ago, but I think what's changed is the narrative, the discourse, because there are other sources of information, which has led to all kinds of movements like the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, which is a direct result, I think, of the increasing availability of video evidence of all these things happening around the country, almost with impunity. So, I think times have changed. It's hard to predict exactly where it's going to go, whether it's going to result in other civil unrest. I mean, that's always a possibility when things go unresolved for too long. But certainly, it's at the front of the agenda now in ways that in the past it wasn't. It was just so-and-so was brutalized, and they complained about it. The police denied it. Maybe it festered for a few days, but, you know, that was the end of the coverage. Now these things, you know, are at the top of the agenda, you know, continually, and I think that is healthy because we have real issues we have to deal with in this country.
And taking this back down to the level of our city, and since you've been thinking about this for so many years, how much do you think the LAPD really has improved since 1991?
Well, I mean, there have been some improvements. I mean, getting Daryl Gates out as police chief was a huge improvement, and we had a series of police chiefs after that, some pretty good, some not so good. You know, there was a little bit more civilian oversight, you know, the Board of Commissioners, attempts to move toward community policing. I mean, all of the reforms haven't sort of succeeded, but there have been gestures toward doing the right thing that, quite frankly, just weren't there in the past in the LAPD. There were some public opinion surveys taken in recent years to show that most groups have a little bit more confidence now in the LAPD than they had back in 1991, 1992. Of course, African Americans, I believe, remains the group that has the least amount of confidence in LAPD, but even their numbers are higher than they were 25 years ago. So I guess you could say that's a sign of progress, but there's just an awfully long way to go.
We'll leave it there. Darnell Hunt is a sociology professor and director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA and the author of Screening, The Los Angeles Riots, Race, Seeing, and Resistance. And really good of you to talk with us. Thank you.
It was great to be here.
Well, clearly technology has changed the way police incidents are captured, viewed, and shared. But how has social media been used to shape the national conversation that follows? For instance, Black Lives Matter is now a household phrase, but how did that come to be? And in what ways have the activists behind the movement used online media to try to affect real-world change? Dean Freeland studied this for American University's Center for Media and Social Impact. He's an assistant professor of communications there, and it's good to have you on the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, so much has changed, and some things haven't, since the beating of Rodney King by LAPD officers that was captured on video. Now, that video could go viral almost instantly, and activists can immediately attach their name to it in social media, as we saw with the Black Lives Matter movement. So take us back to 2013, when Black Lives Matter began as a hashtag, and remind us just how it started.
Sure. So in 2013, three activists in the Bay Area created the Black Lives Matter hashtag in the wake of the acquittal of George Zimmerman, who shot Trayvon Martin in 2012. And so for a while, actually over about a year, the hashtag was not actually used very much. It was not used in the context of a social movement. It wasn't used in the context of activism. In fact, we have data that shows that in June 2014, the hashtag was used only 48 times, right? And so if you fast forward to the immediate months after the Ferguson protests, we see it being used thousands of times, first among activists and later among broader supporters and opponents who are commenting on police brutality issues on Twitter.
And you and your fellows then went on and you sifted through nearly 41 million tweets, and you say that you can see when hashtag Black Lives Matter just went mainstream, when it exploded. When was that?
Absolutely. That that can actually be pinpointed to one specific day, and that's November 24th, 2014. That was the day that St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough announced that Darren Wilson, the man who shot Michael Brown, would not be indicted. And so we can actually look specifically at that Twitter data and show that something on the order of 80,000 tweets were posted in the last 4 hours of the day, Central Time. So this is right around the time the announcement comes down. So that was really the moment. Before that, it was mostly among activists and people who were really, really protesting and closely engaged on the issue. But that was the moment where the hashtag really, really went national. There were two other events after that, including the non-indictment of Eric Garner's killer in Staten Island and a massive day of protests on December 13th, 2014, when the hashtag got a lot of exposure on those days as well. But the first day that it really, really went national in a big way was November 24th, 2014.
And national, of course, because it's a domino effect. The media notices all of this this Twitter action, and then it becomes the national conversation. But anyone can use any hashtag they want on social media, and there were other hashtags being used following Ferguson and also the shooting death of Michael Brown. So why did hashtag Black Lives Matter win out over, say, hashtag Ferguson or hashtag Hands Up Don't Shoot?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and our data don't exactly allow us to answer that question definitively. It's difficult to know. One thing that's really interesting, though, is that there were a number of competitors, hashtags, as you say, Ferguson, Hands Up Don't Shoot, Justice for All, but it's very interesting that the one hashtag that did go national and become a household name is one that framed the police brutality conversation in explicitly racial terms, right? So one could say that, okay, it might be strategically better not to frame it in racial terms than simply to talk about police brutality and how bad it is. But, I think activists took a real risk in sort of going there, as it were, and saying that this is an issue that disproportionately affects black people. And the fact that that was the one that really went national, I think, is a bit of a surprise.
So perhaps broaden the conversation. But let's be clear, there are hashtags, and then there are online communities.
Sure.
And communities, period.
Right.
And Black Lives Matter activists weren't the only community talking about excessive police force on social media. So what other online communities were taking part in that conversation, and what did you learn studying them about how conversations evolve over time?
Sure. There were a number of other communities. One was a community of conservative individuals who were very, very strongly engaged on the issue starting during Ferguson, and they mostly opposed the protesters and activists, with two exceptions, right? So there was Eric Garner's killer was acquitted in December 2014, a number of conservatives really expressed shock that that happened. We saw a similar situation when the video of Walter Scott being shot in South Carolina circulated in April 2015. There was lots of shock and lots of almost kind of sympathy with the protesters. So the conservatives was one group. Another group was Young Black Twitter. So this is a group of folks who don't typically talk about politics a lot. They mostly talk about, you know, the things that young people talk about, music, celebrities, sports. But when something happens that specifically affects their group, then they do talk about it. And it's interesting because the Young Black Twitter community talks about police brutality and these issues very, very differently from the way that the Black Lives Matter community talks about it. They tell a lot of jokes about it, which is kind of interesting, sort of dark humor, to sort of take the edge off of something that affects them directly. And they don't engage in quite as much systemic critique. Right, so they're not critiquing white supremacy. They're not agitating for systemic change. They just sort of memorialize it in very, very simple and unadorned ways.
Well, then, stepping back and looking at the big picture now, in what ways did the use of the hashtag Black Lives Matter online and this discussion on social media have an offline, real-world impact?
Well, I think one of the things they did was to take just the phrase Black Lives Matter national, right? So to put that into people's minds, to let them know that they believe this, and so that even just to have that to be a major topic of conversation, both online and offline, I think is a huge achievement. So that's one. Another is getting this to be something that is discussed by the 2016 presidential candidates, right? So especially on the Democratic side, we see both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders talking about this a great deal, probably somewhat less on the Republican side, although there has been some discussion. And also the ability to formulate specific policy demands. And so if you think about something like Campaign Zero, which was started by Black Lives Matter activists, this is a 10-point plan of changes that they want to see nationally. And it sort of began among the folks that were talking about these issues on Twitter and other online spaces.
Since we are memorializing this 25th anniversary of Rodney King, and you have immersed your brain in these 41 million tweets, I am curious what your thoughts are on how much has changed and how much has stayed the same.
Right. Well, I think that as the hashtag names of many of the police killing victims over the past couple of years have shown, not enough has changed. Right. So I think that with regard to police conduct, there's still a lot of work to be done. But I think one thing that has changed is, of course, social media. Social media didn't exist in 1992, and so what you see is an increased capacity of activists and their supporters to get their specific version of the story out. So in 1992, they had to rely primarily on the mass media, newspapers and radio shows and TV to get their to sort of filter their message out. Now they can communicate directly with the public through Twitter and other social media outlets, and that, I think, is one of the reasons why this movement has been able to have the impact that it's had.
Dean Freeland's report is called Beyond the Hashtags, Ferguson, Black Lives Matter, and the Online Struggle for Offline Justice. Really interesting. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Well, tweet us your thoughts. Are you a hashtag activist? How have you engaged in an online movement? At KCRW Press Play to share your hashtag thoughts on Twitter. And coming up, many of you are tweeting from smartphones, and the FBI wants in. We'll have the latest on how Apple is fighting the order to open up the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino shooters. And are emojis sexist? It's the Web Roundup coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. The battle between the FBI and Apple continues, and now Congress has gotten involved. We're going to talk about all of that and more tech news with Shenny Jardin. She's co-editor of BoingBoing.net, and it's so great to have you back.
It's great to be here, Barbara.
Okay, let's start with the House and the hearings about the battle between Apple and the FBI and unlocking the iPhone. Where do we stand now?
Man, this has been quite a story. Over the past week, it's just exploded in all directions. It's funny, you know, yesterday when I was blogging about this, I started writing hashtag Apple versus FBI, and then I thought, wait a minute, maybe it's hashtag FBI versus Apple. But whichever way you spin the battle, there is a battle. So there was a hearing on two hearings on Capitol Hill, one on the Senate side and one on the House side. Two lawmakers have introduced legislation on the House side that proposes a kind of 9/11 commission for security in the age of the Internet of Things. They don't seem, it has some kind of very Washington name.
And so interesting that the former FBI head has come straight out and said, I'm not on the FBI side in this. I don't approve of unlocking this door because it leads to opening the Pandora's box.
Yeah, and even, boy, so I watched the hearings with James Comey, the head of the FBI. One of the interesting things in that, whatever it was, 6 hours of C-SPAN drama, you know, when we tune into these things, we expect to fall asleep. But what we're seeing is, I don't think that our Congress is going to pass any laws anytime soon that open the floodgates. I saw criticism. I saw pushback. I also saw a lot of awful analogies for what encryption is. Oh my gosh. At one point they were saying, like, we've got to get the rabid dogs away from the door so we can unlock the door so it doesn't burn down. And I'm like, do you guys even use crypt? Like, do you even know what encryption is? The story continues to kind of metastasize, and I think it's really fascinating. You know, there's also some sort of feedback from around the world. There are reports burbling up that ISIS's IT desk is now telling people don't use crypto products created in the U.S. because the FBI's probably already backdoored it.
Well, we have to move on, and I want to move on to another story of law enforcement and social media, because last week we talked about how the Obama administration was enlisting the help of technology and entertainment companies to fight terrorists online, but some terrorism is personal. It's not political, and British prosecutors now have announced that they've asked Twitter to help them fight online abuse. So first, why do prosecutors have to ask? Is Twitter so deaf to abuse on its site that they're not already working with law enforcement in the UK?
Yeah, well, I actually reached out to somebody at Twitter about this story. Basically, there's a lot of headlines this week about the abuse specifically of women. Obviously, any woman who works online has probably experienced violence and harassment of some kind. I speaking for myself, as a woman who's been working online for more than 20 years, violence, harassment, abuse on Twitter, gendered abuse, it's just a part of doing my job. And that's very sad. I wouldn't want, you know, my daughter to experience that. But so Twitter is working with prosecutors in the UK now to help them understand basically how these kinds of crimes happen, how predators on Twitter go about using the particulars of the network to make victims' lives miserable.
Well, it's really hard to prosecute these kinds of crimes or this kind of abuse. There's abuse and then there's criminal action. And I'm thinking of a story that broke today about a woman who received death threats on Facebook. That she's in New Jersey and the man who threatened her is in Texas. And that's the kind of thing, these issues of jurisdiction that make these cases so sticky. So how is that being hashed out? And are the social media networks being proactive in helping legislators or working with law enforcement to make these crimes easier to prosecute?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think that Twitter is kind of caught in a weird place with this issue. Twitter receives a lot of criticism for not doing more in the design of its service to make things harder for abusers and harassers. And
we're talking about moderation now?
any number of solutions, but Twitter hasn't made solving the abuse problem as big of a priority as meeting the demands of its shareholders. So we have moments, we have GIFs, we have all these funny little bells and whistles, but we also have many of the most prominent female voices on the site being bullied in horrible gendered ways all the time. And look, this is something that hits home for me. Some time ago, I had like abusers online who were targeting me, and they posted a picture of my mom's home, and they said, you know, people should go track this person down and rape her. Just all this awful, yucky stuff. And I called law enforcement, and I called attorneys, and I said, you know, guys, this is kind of ruining my life right now. What do you think I should do? And they were like, you know, if they say that they're going to come to your house at a particular time with a particular weapon, maybe we can do something. But otherwise, I don't know, you know, turn off your computer.
Okay, and we just have time for one last quick hit, and involves, well, you could say kind of online attack on women, but it's much more subtle. According to a survey of 1,000 women conducted by a feminine products company, younger women feel like emojis are a little sexist. For instance, the emoji for cop is a man, while the dancer emoji is a woman. So what do you think? How much of an issue is
this? I think this is the stupidest headline ever, but then, like, I also get it. I mean, I use emoji a lot. I'm a very kind of wacky.
You are very expressive.
I'm a very
with images.
Expressive
yes.
person, and I think visually. So I love emoji, but I too wish that there was I don't know, like a picture of a dancing lady that looks more like me instead of a super glamorous woman.
You mean
woman
a dancing lady with hips?
Yeah,
yes.
I don't know. Or
like, thank you very much.
Or more realistic images of women that might be designed by women. But, dude, there are bigger and more oppressive, awful things happening in America at this moment than smiley faces.
Right. And I'm thinking if it exists, it will be an emoji at one point or another eventually.
Donald Trump's hair. That's the emoji. Like, that's worse than the poop one.
Okay. And in all things considered emojis, all emojis considered, a group is proposing ways that
all
would
emojis considered. Oh, that's a good one, Barbara.
That would allow you to modify your own emojis, which
this
doesn't
I'm into.
Seem like financially possible, but how would that work? Is that the next thing on the emoji horizon?
If we can dream it, somebody in a server room
emoji
can build it.
Yeah.
DIY emoji. I love that. I would love to be able to send a tiny little emoji of my dog Chappie to you when I tell you how much I enjoyed being on the show today.
And I can't wait to get it.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Jenny. Jenny Jardin, she's co-editor of BoingBoing.net and joins us every week. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, what do you think? Are you bothered that emoticons are sexist? Is Twitter doing too little to stem online abuse? Let us know on our Facebook page or Twitter. KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Kim Barker covered the war in Afghanistan in the mid-2000s. She wrote a book about the often surreal situations she found herself in, like the time the Prime Minister of Pakistan asked her out.
He gave me the line, which is, I know I'm not as tall as you want, I'm not as fit as you want, I'm fat and I'm old, but I'd still like to be your friend.
Kim Barker's book is now a new movie starring Tina Fey. We'll talk to Barker next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Madeline Brand.
The start of the movie is set in 2003 when the conflict in Afghanistan is going on simultaneously with the war in Iraq, and it's stretched the cable news channel that she works for thin, and then she's presented with the opportunity of, listen, like, we need all hands on deck. Does anybody want to go to Afghanistan? And you have the chance to be on camera. And Kim, in the movie, is a person who's a little bit bored with her job and a little bit stuck in her life, and just says, like, yeah, I'll go.
And that's Tina Fey describing Kim Baker, her character from the new film Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. She's based on the real-life journalist Kim Barker, who served as the South Asia bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune from 2004 to 2009. During the time she covered the war in Afghanistan and also reported from Pakistan, she wrote about her experiences in her book, The Taliban Shuffle, which came out in 2011. It's a darkly comic memoir recounting life in the so-called Kabul, the Kabul enclave of journalists, government officials, NGO workers, fixers, and others brought together by war. New York Times critic Michiko Kakutani wrote a review describing Barker as a sort of Tina Fey character who unexpectedly finds herself addicted to the adrenaline of war. And after that, it didn't take long for Tina Fey to convince Paramount Pictures to option the memoir. Joining me now is Kim Barker, the inspiration for Kim Baker. And welcome to the program, Kim.
Thanks for having me here. It all gets pretty meta pretty quickly.
Well, exactly. And that's my first question. You know, the movie's inspired by your life, but it is fictionalized. So, and you've said the movie isn't truth, but it's truthy. So how
exactly.
So?
Yeah, it's I mean, there's a lot more explosions and cocaine in the movie than there was in my real life. Kim Baker is a, I'm now having to refer to myself in the third person. Kim Baker is a braver journalist than Kim Barker, the journalist. I tend to run away from explosions as opposed to running toward them. And also, I am a newspaper reporter, not a TV journalist. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right. And you weren't really running away from a midlife crisis, right?
No, I was
as Tina Fey does in the movie.
No, I wasn't. I look at it as running towards something as opposed to running away from something. I mean, after 9/11, you know, as a journalist and as a news journalist, I wanted to go to where the story was. And the Chicago Tribune was trying out a lot of new potential foreign correspondents and letting Metro reporters go overseas. And I put my hand up, especially as soon as I heard that they were looking to try out more women. Because, you know, we had been keeping track, me and, you know, some of the other women at the Tribune as to who was getting to go to New York and D.C. and getting to try out overseas. And the ratio was, you know, it's pretty much mostly men. So as soon as I heard that they were trying to try out some more women, I immediately volunteered.
Right. So you took that on. But you were a rookie foreign correspondent. And
oh, yeah.
even your parents were shocked, right, when you told them about this new gig?
I mean, here's the deal. I had not even been to Europe before I went to Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And you did make some rookie mistakes. And I'm noticing in the movie, Tina Fey pulls out a big wad of cash in front of the airport. And of course, it flies all over.
Yeah, it does. And when I first went to Afghanistan, I actually forgot my money in Pakistan. And I asked the guy I was going around with, I'm like, yeah, can you take me to the nearest ATM? And this is January of 2002. And he's like, yeah, you're in a war zone. There are no ATMs here. There's not even power, you know? So, I mean, I did totally make rookie mistakes. And I think that, like, a lot of rookie foreign correspondents make these mistakes. They just don't usually write about them in a book.
Right, and get Tina Fey to portray them in a movie.
Well, right, because I think that, like, you know, a lot of foreign correspondent memoirs, it's like they're the smartest person in the room, right? You know, it's like, and that's the benefit of hindsight. You can look at everything through that lens. And I very much wanted to show myself growing, you know, into this role and tell my actual narrative arc and also use self-deprecating humor to tell the story because, you know, I didn't want to write like a darkly comic book where I was just making fun of Afghans and Pakistanis because, you know, they probably have had enough at this point.
Well, let's talk about this term I mentioned, the cup bubble. It shows up in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Sure.
And of course, as I said, it refers to this culture of all the foreigners like international journalists and security contractors and NGO workers who are thrown together because of the war. And the cliche is that it was, and situations like this in war zones are like the last days of Rome or something.
Yeah.
So what is it like to be in the middle of all of that?
I mean, in the book, I wanted to show this scene because, you know, and I'm very much, you know, the reader's gateway into this really strange world. And I was really shocked by it. And I was struck by it. The fact that I didn't bring any clothes when I went to Afghanistan for going out at night. You know, and I remember when I was invited to my first party, you know, I was like, I had to wear, you know, my the prior correspondent's like baggy t-shirt I think she used to sleep in, because I had nothing else that was remotely Western. And, you know, I had hiking boots, and I went into this party, and there's like all these, you know, women looking fabulous in high heels and little black dresses and feather boas. And I was shocked by this. And I wanted to include this stuff in the book for a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, it's when you're covering really horrible things during the day and you're doing, you know, things that are really stressful and you don't really have the sort of release that you do, you know, back home. You can't go to the gym. You can't go for a run. You feel, you know, very constricted, very restricted. You can't even walk down the street without people staring at you. So, you know, the release we had was this really bizarre party scene. You know, and like I write about the fact there was a toga party in Kabul. I think there was a Talibs and Tarts party at one point. And so I wanted to include that stuff in there put myself in it, because otherwise I'd be a hypocrite. And also, you know, I wanted to show the readers how strange that was and how I feel like a lot of the folks who were there, you know, the contractors who were making so much money and didn't even really know any Afghans and were just sort of looking at it as, you know, just this money pit. I wanted to show the decadence of the way we were living over there and the restaurants that would cater to foreigners and allow foreigners in there because they, you know, served alcohol but did not allow Afghans in. And it just struck me, like, you know, what would it be like in America if there were all these restaurants that didn't allow Americans in? I mean, can you imagine?
Well, it is such a world.
It was really strange. It was really strange.
Strange, weird extremes. And the movie does get into this odd dichotomy that on the one hand, you're living in a world where women have to wear a veil and have no sexual freedom. But on the other hand, as this rare female foreign reporter, you're suddenly Kabul cute.
In Afghanistan, you're a serious piece of ass. In New York, you're like 6'7". Here, you're 9, borderline 10.
Was the 4-10-4 rule really a thing, or was that coined for the film?
That's actually a real thing. There weren't that many female expats compared to the men. There was just way more men. You know, so I said we were Kabul cute or mission pretty. So yeah, no, I do write about that in the book.
Well, getting to the journalism part of the story, as the war in Afghanistan went on, the movie character Kim Baker finds it harder and harder to get her stories aired on TV. And when she confronts the network brass, she learns that it's because of ratings, right? Audiences are just tired of hearing about the war. Did you also have to fight war news fatigue as a print reporter?
I mean, I'm sure I did. They never phrased it to me so succinctly as like people are tired of war. I mean, obviously the Chicago Tribune had put the resources in to have me over there. And I'd like to think that I told different enough stories and it wasn't all just banging on about, you know, firefights every single day. But hey, yeah, the longer I was there, the more it was difficult to get good stories at the length I thought they deserved into the newspaper. It was very difficult to get out front. And I had to deal with a new owner in Sam Zell, who would go around publicly questioning why the Tribune had anybody in Afghanistan. And I was like, man, I'm risking my life here. I mean, it's not like bullets are flying all the time, but I'm doing great work and I'm doing different stories than the other outlets. And it always just struck me as so insulting. So, yeah, damn right. I came back at one point. I'm like, you let me talk to Sam Zell. That guy's supposed to be a maverick. You know, I'll show him a maverick. And they were, you know, my bosses were like, you're not talking to Sam Zell, by the way.
Well, you did have to stand up as a female journalist to a lot of interesting attitudes towards you from officials in Afghanistan. And I want to play a clip from the film. In this scene, Alfred Molina plays the Attorney General of Afghanistan. And here's how he describes the character.
He is really a sort of like a liaison between the journalists and the people that the journalists want to interview and so on. But he also has his own agenda, one of them being that he finds himself strangely attracted to Kim Baker.
And here's an interaction from the film between Molina's attorney general and Baker.
You should let me interview you.
But I do not know you. How can we get to know each other?
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But the high-level official who took a liking to you wasn't the Afghan attorney general. He was the former prime minister to Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif. So was Sharif as obvious a flirter as Molina's portrayal would lead us to believe?
Well, I mean, to be fair, I think that the attorney general was also flirting with me, not to sit there and categorize myself as some temptress. But, I mean, the attorney general actually did ask me things like that. The future attorney general, and he did take me shooting to his home village, and he did show me a bed in his office. So all those things are actually very accurate. But and I write about that in the book. But then I also write about, I mean, at the time, Nawaz Sharif was the former prime minister of Pakistan. He is now the prime minister of Pakistan again. And yeah, it was that sort of forward. I mean, he bought me an iPhone so that we could talk, you know, away from the ISI, which is one of Pakistan's spy services, so we could talk without them listening in on what we were saying. I did not accept that gift. You know, he offered to find me a friend and, you know, asked me what I was looking for in a man. And I said, you know, tall, funny, and smart. And he told me that, you know,
not Martin Freeman.
He told me that it was difficult to find a tall man in Pakistan, because it was a short country. Nawaz is funny. Then eventually he gave me the line, which is, I know I'm not as tall as you want. I'm not as fit as you want. I'm fat and I'm old, but I'd still like to be your friend. That's kind of like the similar levels of absurdity.
Well, jumping ahead to after your book came out, when you first read or heard of yourself, described as a sort of Tina Fey character in that New York Times review.
Sure.
What went through your mind? Did you imagine, oh, hello, Tina Fey? I wonder if she read that.
That review was so glowing. Michiko ended up like naming it one of her top 10 books of the year. I was just so shocked and total by the review and by how she got exactly what I was trying to do. So I was more focusing on, you know, the New York Times review than Tina Fey. And it was somebody else at work who was like, you know, you might want to get that book sent over to Tina Fey's people because maybe she'd want to option it. And I think her people separately found it and found the review. And she read the book within two weeks of that book coming out and pushed both Lorne Michaels, you know, to get involved and to see whether he thought that it could be made into a movie, and to push Paramount to option the book on her behalf. All of that took 2 weeks from that review, less than 2 weeks from that review coming out. So the night of my actual book party in New York, you know, I got the call basically saying that they were optioning it. You know, it's really unreal.
Kim Barker, she's an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and Whiskey Tango Foxtrot was based on her memoir, The Taliban Shuffle. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, coming up on this show, and thank you for that, we have special interests that are making it rain ballot initiatives in California this year, so we're sticking closer to home. And some of those initiatives are they're more, let's say, feasible than others. We'll run down some of the more far-fetched efforts next on Press Play.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Well, California voters could be in for a bumper crop of ballot measures in November. One quippy Democratic campaign strategist said, the voter's pamphlet is going to look like the Encyclopedia Britannica. I don't think younger voters are even going to get that. But anyway, there are initiatives on gun control, minimum wage, taxes on cigarettes, and shrinking public pensions. Also, millions of dollars will be spent on a measure to legalize pot. The pharmaceutical industry has already put $40 million into defeating an initiative that would limit how much the state can pay for prescription drugs. And the plastic bag industry is spending millions to defeat a bag ban. But for every measure that makes it onto the ballot, there are many that never get that far. Legalizing the possession, importation, and transportation of pet ferrets? Anyone? Hillel Aaron is a reporter for the LA Weekly, and he joins me now to tell us about some of the initiatives we probably won't have to confront in the voting booth come November. Welcome, Hillel.
Hello.
Okay, before we get to the fun stuff, first, what does it take to get an initiative onto the ballot in the first place in California?
$200 and 365,880 signatures. The number of signatures is determined by the previous gubernatorial election, which is in part why we're seeing so many of these ballot measures, because the last gubernatorial election, which was Jerry Brown's last reelection, the voter turnout was pretty low. So that makes the threshold lower than normal.
Okay, so that's what's lowered the bar and why we're seeing so many.
Exactly. Also, the legislature in 2011, I believe it was, said there can no longer be ballot measures on primary elections. So now we're basically stuffing all the ballot initiatives into the November ballot.
Okay, well, let's pick a colorful one out of the bag, the so-called NASCAR initiative.
Yeah, this one probably got the most amount of attention. Being pushed by this guy, John Cox, who's actually got two making the rounds, but this one definitely got the most attention. It's based on a Robin Williams stand-up routine, which basically proposes that politicians have to go around with the labels of their top 10 donors. So if you took a donation from PG&E, you would wear that on your suit, much like a NASCAR driver.
I am loving it. This could solve all of our problems.
Well, not all our problems.
Nationwide.
It would be fun. I think people just like the idea that our politicians be ritually humiliated on a regular basis. So, and this is actually one of the ones that John Cox is spending money on this.
Yeah, he spent $1 million, which that's a lot of money,
yeah,
isn't it?
He told someone he was going to spend $1 million. I'm not actually sure how much he spent. Oh. It is a lot of money, although it's not clear if that's going to be enough. There are so many ballot measures going out for signatures, it's inflated the price of getting the signatures. It's rare that these actually use volunteers. Most of them pay people to get signatures, which is why you see those guys standing outside your supermarket carrying like a stack of five clipboards. They actually get paid per signature. And right now the going rate is up to $4.50, which is a lot.
Yeah. Well, there's another initiative for California Nationhood. How does that
work? Yeah, this one I sort of think we should be considering a little bit. It doesn't actually say that California should secede from the United States. It does, however, say that we should put that question before voters on every single ballot every 4 years starting in November 2020.
Every 4 years.
Yeah, every 4 years. So,
well, you know, they should have packaged this with the measure that hasn't qualified, that we call the governor of California the president instead.
Well,
it seems like that's
sometimes
a twin.
The best ideas are the most simple ones. You know, President Jerry Brown has a nice ring to it. I'm sure he thinks so.
I think there's also a measure that has to do with schools teaching Holocaust denial, and the sponsors want that banned.
Yeah, and there's a thing on the Secretary of State website that basically says, you know, this might not be constitutional, but it would ban any teaching that denies the Jewish, Armenian, and Ukrainian Holocausts.
But there is that pesky Constitution. I mean,
yeah, and you know, you could certainly see something maybe in the education code for public schools or for textbooks or something. But this one goes a bit further and says, you know, any educational institution or museum that gets state funds, and that sort of starts to get a little tricky, I would imagine.
Well, there were quite a few other ones that have already been rejected. I mentioned the one that legalizes the possession, importation, and transportation of pet ferrets. Apparently, ferrets' time has not come. But tell us about the shellfish ban that didn't make it.
Yeah, I actually had never heard of this one until I started reading it, but I'll just read from it. Make sale or consumption of shellfish a serious felony, punishable by $666,000 fine per occurrence and or a prison sentence of up to 6 years, 6 months, and 6 days.
Aside from the kosher lobby, I just did not know there was so much hating on shellfish.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with various religious texts. But clearly there has to be some sort of religious thing there.
Well, so how many measures might actually end up on the ballot this November?
I think consultants are expecting there to be anywhere from 15 to 25, which is a lot. I mean, you fit about three of these things on a page of a ballot because you have to have a whole paragraph. So that actually makes the ballot quite long. And consultants say that for every additional measure, 1% of the electorate stops paying attention and stops voting. So if you have 20 ballot measures, the last measure that's listed basically gets 20% less turnout.
Wow, so that can really undermine
it can really undermine and
your democratic process.
If you're spending a lot of money to try to, say, legalize marijuana or force the adult film industry to wear condoms on porn shoots, you'd be pretty pissed off if you're number 22 out of 22.
Well, along these lines, it seems like we should expect a measure limiting measures.
Yeah, and I believe somewhere there's actually a ballot measure to put more ballot measures on the ballot. I don't think I included this one in my post, but someone I believe is gathering signatures to make certain laws, to make more laws have to go before voters that the legislator passes.
Okay, they might need to read your piece more carefully then.
Come on, Barbara, voting's fun. Who doesn't love voting?
Thanks so much. It was great talking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for running them down for us. Hillel Aaron, he's a reporter at the LA Weekly. Well, hello, Jolie Myers. Lay some feedback on us.
If you want to get people to vote, mm-hmm. just threaten to take away their mollusks.
That's right.
That would turn out voters. So we talked about online Twitter harassment today, and Reginald James, clearly a man, shared a really interesting story. He plays Xbox, and his handle makes it sound like he might be a woman. Well, he has experienced crazy harassment from the people he plays video games with online, including the men on his team shooting him before the action even starts because they don't want a female member of their team.
Well, now he knows.
Yeah. So that's a very interesting story. If you have stories of your own, share them on Twitter, KCRW Press Play.
Well, that does it for us today, and I'll be back in the host seat tomorrow. I hope we'll see you tomorrow then. Take care.